You're listening to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games and role-playing gamers.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves.
Hello and welcome to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast, well, once every 2 weeks podcast about role-playing games and the gamers who game them. My name is Ran Avram and Uri is not with us today. Instead, I have a James.
Hello,
hello James. Please introduce yourself. Who are you, James?
I'm James Graham. I work at Leisure Games in the UK. I'm a gamer. And I also now do the crowdfunding section for D100 News.
And how come I seem to know your name and recognize your voice? Have you been here before?
I believe I was on the podcast about this time last year.
And what were we talking about then?
We were talking about the top-selling games of 2017.
At Leisure Games, and out of that we sort of then expanded the discussion and talked about the industry in 2017, and now we'll do the same for 2018, because things have changed. And we would like to keep our hand on the pulse, as we say in Hebrew. And I'm not sure that actually that same idiom exists in English.
No, that's about right. Yeah.
Okay. Then let's see. Let's just cut right through it. What are the top 10 role-playing games sold in Leisure Games this year? And let's compare it to last year.
So shall we talk about just the overall best games or the new ones first?
Ooh, interesting. Okay, then let's start with the new ones, because that's interesting, yeah.
So, in that case, number 10, I'm assuming we're going upwards, number 10 yes. is The Legend of the Five Rings Core Rulebook,
which
is obviously Fantasy Flight's new kind of relaunch of Legend of the Five Rings. Very different rule set.
Yes, vaguely based on the Genesis sort of thing with custom dice, etc. I bought for you guys the starter set, and I really liked it.
Cool.
I like it because it's very complicated. Right. The system is complicated. It's crunchy. There's a lot going on with basically only two types of dice this time, not gazillion, only two. But you do a lot with them. And there's so much, like you would expect in Legend of the Five Rings, which is all about semi-fantasy, Japanese-like culture, a lot to do with how you behave yourself and honor, and which is, of course, the start, and your place in society and stuff like that. All of it is very crunchy. And I liked it a lot in the starter set. The adventure is really good in starter set. So I'm not surprised that the core book got attention. Of course, for people who don't know, Legend of the Five Rings have been going on for many years has some very avid fans that, well, I assume that like what Fantasy Flight did with Warhammer, where they changed the rule set from cover. I mean, it's very different from what it was before, the FFG's take on how Warhammer and how Legend of the Five Rings looks is so different that many fans won't buy into it, but perhaps many do.
I haven't come across of the same sort of backlash that Warhammer 3rd Edition had, because there was a quite vociferous backlash at the time.
Yes, I think it was also because it was the first time they did something with Fiji dice, and there were a lot many cards and tokens, and you had a lot you need to swallow.
It was possibly a bit before its time, third edition, Wuffrup, as we call it in the business. Yeah. but this one I've generally only heard people saying positive things about, and be quite excited by. So, certainly it seems to be picking up. The old players seem to be fairly happy transitioning into it. Obviously, a lot of people, they have all the books, they're done, they don't need it. But people seem to be relatively content with this one, which is good.
Let's continue to number 9.
Okay, so the next one is a bit of a weird one. Number 9 is the Glorantha Sourcebook. So this isn't technically a role-playing book. This is a background book for lots of role-playing games, including Hero Quest and also RuneQuest. And of course, RuneQuest didn't make our top 10 list, but that's mainly because I think we kept selling out and we haven't been able to get restocks. So I think that was the main reason that didn't manage to get there. But this is the kind of source book, the background material for that. Continues to sell quite well. Lots of people very excited about the new edition of RuneQuest. And as we speak, kind of itching for the last two of the kind of core books to come out, which should be coming out any day now. And it's very frustrating. I speak as someone who is very frustrated waiting for that to come out.
There's also a Glorantha expansion for 13th Age, if I remember correctly.
There is, yep. That's done quite well as well. It's funny that they have kind of all come out at the same time. I think that was a kind of timing issue, because I think the 13th Age of Glorantha was supposed to be coming out a couple of years ago, and there were various delays and so on, the way Kickstarters happen. But yeah, so everything, both that and RuneQuest, have both come out basically in the same month.
Again, for those who don't know, Glorantha and RuneQuest and HeroQuest are all basically the same. Very ancient in role-playing games terms, ancient 30 years ago.
You made me feel really old. Thanks
for that. setting that rose to much popularity thanks to, I think it was HeroQuest. I think it was the first iteration of it. Correct me if I'm wrong.
RuneQuest was the first version, and then RuneQuest had a very storied history, and then Hero Wars came out in the end of the 90s, and then that turned into Hero Quest.
Good for them.
Yeah.
It's interesting because it's a pretty cool world. It has a lot of things, but it's not your fantasy kitchen sink. It is fantasy. It is high, epic sort of fantasy. It's a bit crazy all over the place. And I really like the magic system, the three magic systems, the complicated sort of a way that things interact there. Never played it. Only read about it.
Well, I for me, it was my very first role-playing game. So I have a bit of a soft spot for it. But yeah, it has a very clear vision. Greg Stafford, who sadly died last year, very much had a very clear agenda in terms of what he wanted, and he had a background in folklore and very much a kind of follower of kind of Joseph Campbell, and a lot of that gets poured into the whole Glorantha RuneQuest stuff. And it's still going on. So this new version of RuneQuest is kind of the version I think he wanted to make 20 years ago, and for various reasons wasn't able to. So it's got a lot of influences of Pendragon, which is the game he did produce in the 1980s, and a lot of the mechanisms that were in that are now in the new edition of RuneQuest.
Let's continue to number 8.
So that is the Fate Horror Toolkit. So last year we had the Fate Adversary Toolkit, and Fate supplements are continuing to do very well. Fate is still one of our top lines. That's done quite well.
Fate is awesome. If Uri was here, he probably would have been able to say something about Fate, but he's not, so we're not. Let's continue to number 7.
So this one is Dungeons & Dragons Waterdeep Dragon Heist, which is the first part, I believe, of the 2-volume Waterdeep campaign that they produced at the end of last year. So this is the low level one. Basically, if a D&D book comes out,
it's going to be,
we get a blast of sales. So that one's done quite well. I've not heard that much buzz about it in terms of people
say, I heard a lot about it. There's one main problem with it. There are 4 villains. When the GM runs it, they choose one villain and uses them, which means that the other 3 villains will not come into the game in any way.
Okay.
So you miss some cool and interesting stuff that you could have used.
But that just means you get to play it four times, surely.
Well, theoretically. I think that maybe that was something they aimed for, but I don't think, as far as I remember, the book does not contain enough material. Not that I care. I'm going to play it as a player.
Right.
Aviv from Up to Four Players, my partner in Up to Four Players, I bought her Waterdeep Dragon Haste at Leisure Games. For her birthday, maybe, I don't know. Oh, she bought it. I didn't buy it for her birthday. I'll buy her for something else for her birthday. She bought it at Leisure Games and I handed it to her. I took it from you guys and she's going to run it for us. And finally I'll be a player after so many years and I'll get to play my Bald Warlock.
Okay.
Let's see.
And of course, the other thing they're doing now with all of their campaigns that they've been released last couple of times is they're also bringing out a board game. So that comes out next week. So you'll be able to play the board game as well as the role-playing game.
Juicy.
Vertical integration.
What's number six?
Number six is it says a new game, but it's a very old game.
Yes.
Original Adventures Reincarnated number one, Into the Borderlands, which I find a mind-boggling book. It is basically the Into the Borderlands module from the, I think, late 70s. And it is every single iteration of that module that has ever been published over all the various editions of D&D, plus a new 5th edition version in one massive, chunky hardback book.
I really like Goodman Games. I like their take on Dungeon Crawling. I very much enjoyed most everything they did for D&D and now Dungeon Crawl Classics. And I was kind of waiting to see their take on the earliest adventures. The problem is, as far as I understand from the reviews, they sort of just translated it into 5 and not recreated it with today's sensibility.
Yeah, it's not a reimagining. It's just a straight adaptation.
And even worse, I don't like the presentation. It's really hard. I've browsed the book. It's really hard to read it. It's hard to run it. It doesn't look good. Yeah. It looks weird. And I think that the reason this is in sixth place is because nostalgia. I'm not really sure people are actually going to maybe even run this.
Yeah, I feel it's a prestige product rather than...
Yes.
It's not like Tales from the Yawning Portal that Wizards did was it last year or the year before last? I forget now. But that was 6 separate classic scenarios that they've readapted for 5th edition, very much with new players in mind, very much designed as a kind of, this is a proper 5th edition reimagining. And I think that for me was a better product. Into the Borderlands really is aimed at the grognards, as we call them, rather than the new players. So I mean, obviously it has its place and that's fine, but it's certainly not, as far as I can see, bringing a new generation into playing Into the Borderlands.
Let us continue to number 5, which is probably the least surprising thing on the list.
So this is the Pathfinder 2nd edition playtest. It's become a growing phenomenon now. I think Fantasy Flight did it first with their Warhammer 40K RPGs, where you bring out the beta. And
you sell it.
You get people to play test and
pay to play money test to do your game. Yes.
And then they bring out the version which you have to buy again. But it works. It's sold moderately well this year. I think a lot of people are waiting for the final 2nd edition.
I'm waiting. It's really good. I mean, you can download the playtest for free.
Indeed.
And still people would buy it, because people who want to play it, I get it. I would, if I wanted to play the playtest, I would have bought a book.
Yeah.
It's just simpler and easier around the table. But it's pretty awesome. I'm quite looking forward to Pathfinder 2nd edition. It looks like it learned some important things from D&D 5. And that's a really good thing for Pathfinders to do.
So my big question to you, and this is, I'm not fully deciding what the answer to that is, should Paizo be doing a second edition, or should they just be leaning into fifth edition and adapting their setting for fifth edition?
I think they should do both. I don't see why not just take both Starfinder and Golarion, the world for Pathfinder, and put them out as settings for D&D 5. Everyone else is doing it anyway.
Indeed.
And it works well for everyone. But I think that they're too busy now with Pathfinder 2 to do that, and that's fine.
Indeed. And of course, its history is very much the bad boys of D&D and how that went with 4th edition. So I guess then they don't, you know, they didn't, then they haven't depended on D&D for a long time.
Yes.
So,
yes.
But it's interesting because I would think that there's a lot of people that would be interested in, particularly things like, you know, Rise of the Rune Lords and things like that.
Oh, yes.
Bringing out for fifth edition, that I would think that would be enormously successful. And I'm a little surprised they're the one company now that isn't rushing for that fifth edition gravy train.
I'm pretty sure it's because they are so busy with Pathfinder Second.
True.
I wouldn't be surprised if this time next year we'll see them announcing the Golarion world or whatever for fifth. And I would buy it because I love Golarion and I would love to play even Rise of the Rune Lords, which I by now know by heart because I played it as Pathfinder Adventure Card Game, I would still want to run it in D&D 5 or maybe Pathfinder 2. God damn it, so many games. Okay, let's continue to number 4.
So this is another Back to the Future. This is Star Wars the Role-Playing Game 30th Anniversary Slipcase.
Yeah.
So this is not the new role-playing games of the last 5 years. This is the West End Games game that I played back in the 80s, that they've done a 30th anniversary, which has an interesting history, particularly for Star Wars fans, because it very much kind of kickstarted the expanded universe and lots of new kind of Star Wars media is still referencing some of the stuff that
it established many of the things that we now consider to be canon and obvious.
Indeed. I'm a little sad, incidentally, that this is just some kind of nostalgia product again.
Mm.
And I'd have loved to see a new edition because, again, personally, I love that game. It uses the D6 system to talk about Greg Stafford again that he created for the old Ghostbusters game. And I think that was a great system. And I would love to see a new edition, but that is not to be, sadly.
I remember that I read a review about this many years ago, and it dumbfounded me that there are mechanics for light side and dark side according to how you behave in the game.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do stuff, you will get points for toward dark side or light side, and that will actually influence things happening. And for a person who was only playing D&D and AD&D at the time, that was eye-opening.
Oh, yeah. And it does, although it's interesting because the mechanics for the first edition didn't have it, but it also had, I think they called it the Force Die, which came out of the Ghostbusters game, which was the Ghost Die, where if you rolled the 6, then something bad happened or some complication happened, which is the sort of mechanism that you now see in the modern Star Wars role-playing game and in a lot of modern role-playing games.
Yes.
But it was kind of the first game to do that. So, yeah, there's a lot of history there, both Star Wars and role-playing in there. So it's a nice bit of nostalgia. Of course, I've got the original copies on my shelf, so I didn't need this.
Let's continue to number 3.
So this is Dungeons & Dragons. This is Mordenkainen's Tome of Foes. So this is their third monster manual, although they are very good at not calling them monster manuals. This one focusing more on the demons and things, and has things like Githyanki, I bet I've said that wrong, and all sorts of kind of more in-depth background stuff. I'm quite a fan of how they're doing these kind of not
because they're interesting.
Manuals.
They're interesting. Yeah. They're not just stats. They actually provide you with lore and stuff. And I kind of like the framing story with Mordenkainen's Tome of Foe. It works. It makes for interesting reads.
Yeah, and it's fun. So it's a very good product. Unlike Dragon Heist, this one had the variant cover, which was available only for retail. And I think that reflects in the sales because what we've found is the retail exclusive covers very much drive up sales retail. Otherwise, people will obviously go to that certain retail website that sells everything cheap, or not always. So that's a very welcome thing that Wizards do for their big releases for D&D.
Well, it's a good point maybe to bring up something that they just changed a few weeks back. Our Wizard announced that they no longer will be providing a 10-day gap opening for LFGSs for the local friendly game stores. Mm-hmm. And instead, everyone online and local games will be getting the book at the same day and will be allowed to start selling it at the same day. Is that a bad thing?
Well, I think from a narrow self-interest point of view, it's not welcome. From a retail point of view, I think that there's interesting things why that must be. It's certainly a statement that retail, that bricks and mortar stores are less of a driver of sales than perhaps they used to be. We can go into why that is. It certainly feels like a demotion in terms of status. But having said that, I mean, if they are still doing the variant covers, those have been very welcome. Those have worked very well. So, it's a mixed bag, basically, and I suppose it just remains to be seen how big an effect that's going to make over the long term.
Let's continue to number two and still talk about Wizards of the Coast, because of course.
Indeed, this is the Core Rulebook gift set. So this is another quite old product. So this is all the core books for D&D, including a screen, if I remember, in a nice big gift set that it actually came out a bit late, but came out just before Christmas. And as you can see, it's number two in our top-selling new games of 2018, so that's how well it sold.
I really like it that it's a gift set, because I'm going to assume most people who bought it didn't buy it for themselves, but instead for someone else.
I think gamers are very good at buying gifts for themselves.
sure.
So I don't know how much that was an actual genuine gift, but certainly, and again, this one had the variant covers, and the variant covers were very nice for this one. I was very tempted to get it myself.
Oh, really? I didn't know even. Wow.
Yes, and most of those sales were the variant covers. It was a very, very popular item. I'm not surprised it sold as well as it did.
Let's continue then. What's number one?
Number one is Scum and Villainy, which is the science fiction space opera hack of Blades in the Dark, which has gone phenomenally well. This is where we enter the realm of leisure games is kind of bubble rather than necessarily how things are going globally in terms of RPG sales. We tend to do very well for certain kind of niche items, and this is one of the books that does very well for us.
So last year, Blades in the Dark was the new number one, and now one of its subtitle?
Spin-off, shall we say.
Spin-off, is number one again. And that's awesome. But when we go over to the top 10, all RPGs of everyone, will see that, let's go through it.
Indeed.
And see who's number one here,
If we move on to our overall, this is not just new items, this is all role-playing games that we've sold over the course. So number 10 is the Star Wars 30th Anniversary slipcase. So that was number 4 of the new books. That's down at number 10 of all the books. And then we come to Apocalypse World 2nd Edition, which is still selling very strong for us. Again, that's probably not something that all shops have found, but
yeah.
Apocalypse World is one of our kind of mainstays in terms of indie games. And then this is probably the interesting one. Number 8 is the Dungeons and Dragons 5th Edition Player's Handbook. Now, that was not in our top 10 last year.
Yes, that's weird. How long has been D&D 5 around? Six years now?
Certainly five. I'm trying to remember now. But yeah, it's been around a fair time.
Yes.
Sales this year, and obviously this is the core, I mean, this is the one book you have to have for D&D.
Yeah.
Sales have actually gone up by 78%. Which is quite a phenomenal sales increase for a game that is as old as that.
So let's go through some of the possible reasons. I mean, the first one, and I think the most obvious one, is streaming services.
Yeah.
When you see so many people around streaming so many types of mostly D&D, not necessarily D&D, but mostly D&D, you will have more people come around and buy the book to check it out, to play it with their friends, whatever. And even if they see people not playing D&D, they might buy D&D because people tell them, you want to get into RPG? Buy D&D and go into it.
I mean, I have to say, as a shop assistant, I will never suggest right from the get-go people buy the Player's Handbook. I will always point them in the direction of the starter set, which I think is a better starting place. But
yes, it's brilliant.
People are clearly graduating to the Player's Handbook, regardless of, you know, anything I'm suggesting. And it genuinely flabbergasted me that sales for D&D have been as strong as that, because obviously we're seeing that. I think I saw Wizards reporting that sales for physical books of D&D have massively skyrocketed, and I'm guessing those sales are doing very well globally. So this is something where we are representative of the wider industry.
I mean, I'm going to assume it's because of the rising tide of streaming. It's not just streaming, but it made everything and everyone able to talk more about D&D. And you can see it's more all over the place, even in mainstream media, etc.
And then, of course, you have the Stranger Things phenomenon as well, which is, I think, made a... I think that's reaching a different audience, but certainly it has kind of entered it into the consciousness again in the way that I remember D&D appearing in E.T. and that being quite a big deal. And that was like back in, 1980 or whatever. And it's kind of a callback to that. But the other thing is, of course, old farts like me, I mean, not personally, but more generally, have teenage and near teenage children now, and are going, look at this game from my youth. And we get quite a lot of dads coming in and essentially pushing the game onto their kids.
Oh, completely too. But for example, I've already started seeing this trend. I've been involved in a lot of organizing convention in Israel, and there's a lot of talk, at least in Israel, it's been mostly about young kids, about 9, 10, and that would be probably the age when you would buy them a Player Handbook, I think.
Yeah.
But I've seen it already happening a few years ago. I mean, it already started, at least in Israel, I'm going to assume a lot of the world, at least a few years ago when the new generation came in. So it is a bit surprising that only now we see this increase, and that it's such a big one compared to last year, not more gradual.
I think it's just a case of critical mass. Critical mass, a good pun. I think it's just basically just reached a point where it's just kind of reached the next level. And that's led to a much higher level of content. I mean, I know lots of friends who always resisted things like Critical Role for a long time, who slipped into it in the last 12 months.
Oh, really?
And I think it's just worn certain people down in terms of... So for a long time, it was that thing that your friend listened to.
Okay,
slowly,
okay.
It's got to the point where it's just reached a saturation point. That's my theory, anyway.
No, it works. For example, there's College Humor, They have a service, now a new service, streaming service called Dropout, which I generally like because I generally enjoy Call of Humor, but they started streaming D&D. And their D&D show is vastly different from Critical Role. It's very, very much a different thing. And I find it that I can now recommend this to people who would not be into Critical Role.
Mm-hmm.
There are many reasons not to be into Critical Role. So that's fine. That works. Not everyone likes the same things. That's fine. Okay. So what is then number seven?
Number seven is the Burning Wheel Codex. Now, last year, that was actually our second best-selling book. And it has slipped all the way down to seventh. I think the main reason for that is that, basically people that have Burning Wheel who wanted Burning Wheel Codex have now got them.
Yeah, it's no longer new.
Yeah. So I think I don't see any particular thing to read into that. But yeah, it has slipped a bit. So then we get to Mordenkainen's Tome of Foes. Again, which is in sixth place of our overall selling. And then the core rulebook gift set in fifth place. And then Burning Wheel Gold. So this is the core book for Burning Wheel. Interestingly, sales for that has shot up, which I have less of an explanation for, apart from maybe we did a better job at keeping it in stock this year. Mm.
Okay.
I don't know. But it has certainly sales from that go from strength to strength. There's going to be a new edition of Burning Wheel Gold. I think it's only a kind of revised edition. It's not a major new version this year. So it'll be interesting to see what sales for that are going to be like this year. So again, this is Leisure Games being Leisure Games, but our Burning Wheel Gold, I do not think worldwide is the fourth best-selling role-playing game.
I assume not.
But it most definitely is for us. And I'm very happy for that to continue. It's a great game. And I have I'm keen that our sales continue to do well.
I disagree adamantly. But let's continue to number three.
We'll move on. Then Dungeon World is in third place. This has actually leapt up one place. And again, sales have gone up quite considerably.
Why? I mean, I have nothing against Dungeon World. I think it's really good. I'm not sure why it has HP. I think it would work better without HP. But besides that, I think it's an excellent game. But why? Why now? Why?
I'm not clear on this myself. This is
Playing Dungeon World in streaming, as far as I know. So I really don't know.
I think it may be because it's a good kind of follow on for if you've played D&D and you want to explore something slightly different.
But so, how would you know that it exists?
I guess Reddit and things like that, people will then basically mention it. Again, it might just be that we've done a better job at keeping it in stock and there is that just residual demand for the game. It may even be other people are not keeping it in stock as well. But yeah, it has done very well for us.
So what's number two then?
Number two is Scum and Villainy, which we've already discussed. And number one is still Blades in the Dark.
Weird. So weird. It's weird.
A lot of the reason I think that is because a company like Evil Hat, I know this is one real phenomenon for a small publisher like them, it's not really in their interest to do mail order internationally. So they do send people our way. And that's obviously very much appreciated. So thanks a lot, Fred. it does also seem that it is one of those things where there's this game, it's very popular, but I think a lot of other game shops just haven't quite picked up on that. And while there is now this, I think, general perception that D&D sales are continuing to do well, some of the more obscure games are also starting to pick up. Because, I mean, our sales for role-playing across the board, I think, have been up in 2018 compared to the previous year. And part of the thing we do well at is the fact that other people, other shops, will only stock the D&D, Call of Cthulhu's, the kind of the heavy hitters.
Okay.
And then people come, are attracted to us because we sell a broader range.
Excellent and brilliant. Okay, so that's your top tens and some of the things we had to say about the industry. Any honourable mention, anything else we should talk about?
So I suppose the ones that just missed, in terms of our overall top-selling games, Ritama deserves an honourable mention.
It's a weird thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a fascinating game. It is basically just kind of a much more gentle game. It's a translation of a Japanese RPG, I should make clear. But basically you are kind of walking along the road, and I think you do have some combat. I keep meaning to give it a try myself. I haven't actually brought it to the table yet, but it has a real kind of cult following. And I believe they've got the same publishers have another game coming out this year. And it'll be interesting to see how well that does. But yeah, that's sold very well. And the other new game that just missed our top 10, as well as RuneQuest, was the Call of Cthulhu Mars of Nyarlathotep suitcase. Now that's a massive. They've taken the classic campaign from, again, the 80s, and they've turned it into this massive two-volume slipcase set with lots of nice little bits and pieces in the slipcase as well. So it's a very nice package. But yeah, not cheap, kind of 100 quid to buy. So the fact that it's selling as well as it does is... And of course, that's true of the D&D gift set as well. These are not cheap books that people are buying in huge numbers. So it does say it seem some of the things that we've got coming that have been our top sales have been kind of nostalgia pieces, but there is still plenty of stuff there that is kind of looking forward as well. So it's a nice mix.
I agree. And that's about it. We're going to head into taking some load off in a moment, but first, how about you plug some things, James?
Okay. Well, I will plug D100 News, which is a new project that I hasten to say I'm doing very little work on, because my friend Amy is doing 90% of the work.
Please, our friend Amy.
Our friend Amy. Everyone's friend Amy. is basically a weekly news source of everything that's happening in the role-playing game sphere. It just kind of takes a big 360 review of everything that's going on. And I think we've been doing it for about 6 weeks now. I think I've lost track. But it is going and slowly growing. So subscribe to it, and we'll send you a weekly email of everything that's happening.
Also, you can follow it at D100 News on Twitter, and we occasionally share them, we retweet them ourselves, and also share you on Facebook as well in our group, by the way, when you
Thank
have
you
some
very much.
Cool things to say. Sure. You might know Amy, by the way, from our episode on inclusivity, where we brought her in to talk about inclusivity. That's the episode, and we'll give a link for everything we've just talked about in the show notes. Finally, if you want to send us an email, do so. It's at show@dwarfcast.net, and we exist all over the internet at dwarfcast.net, and also just Dwarf Podcast wherever there's... I mean, there aren't that many podcasts about dwarves, I think.
A lot of board games about dwarves, but not...
There are, yes, okay, surprising amount. And now it's time to take the load off.
This world is carried on the shoulders of dwarves.
This is the part of the show in which we talk about role-playing games in our personal lives. James, what have you been playing?
I've been playing a lot of Scum and Villainy, following
that. Yes, you have.
I'm probably coming about two-thirds of the way through our campaign. And I know it's been going very well. I've been enjoying it enormously. We've got this... nice little setup of various people who are pretty terrible smugglers and scoundrels. Things are starting to come to a head, and it's getting a bit trippy. It's getting a bit 2001.
You're the GM?
I am indeed the GM, yes.
And how is GMing Scum and Villainy? Is it easy?
I'm finding it harder now than when I first started. Maybe it's because I didn't know what I was doing wrong to begin with. But it does feel like there's a lot of pressure on the GM to remember all the various kind of factors when working out the difficulty for something or the possible consequences and so on. And I feel I need to go back and restudy the rules, which I should do before Tuesday, to remind myself how some of the interactions work, because I keep getting to a point where someone says, I want to do this unexpected thing. And I'm like, please don't do that. I've been struggling a bit. I have been enjoying what I really do like about it. And I think this is similar to Blaze in the Dark, is a good third of the book is setting material, but it's not deep setting material. It's not loads of text.
Like just things that you can use to create some awesome stuff.
It's notes that you can launch your ideas off. And that is phenomenal, particularly
it's brilliant
when you're doing kind of improvisational stuff and adding things. And if all games did that, I would be delighted, because
I'm taking a note from it when I'm writing now the Crystal Heart book. All of the lore section is basically just tidbits, because I think, and they're all capitalized, so if you want to like look for trouble, then you just browse the page and then you see here troubles, because it's capitalized, and then you can say it, and now you know that this, you can get some cool things from reading two sentences and just go ahead and do something with it.
Yeah, so, I mean, in terms of kind of prep, I mean, literally, I just draw a countdown clock at the start of each session and go, well, there you go, that's my prep done. And it works. And, as I say, I struggle a little bit with the mechanics, but overall, I'm very impressed. And but that, as I say, is coming to the end, so then I get back to my One Ring campaign in a couple of months, which I'm very much looking forward to.
I'm currently still playing Savage Worlds, 50 Fathoms. We are actually I think we are in two-thirds campaign as well. And well, we'll end it, as I said before, Aviv will be running Waterdeep, I really hope.
Great.
Will I be a fighter or maybe a barbarian? I don't know. And it's great fun. Finally, last week, something happened that I've been sort of planning for from the beginning. Something that's been chasing the characters, these three Kahanas, which are fish-like people that has been chasing them through my answers to the weekly questions. They never appeared on screen, but occasionally when my wife is the one sending the weekly questions, occasionally I would answer them from the point of view of these three assassin Kahanas that were few stops behind. I mean, they were visiting somewhere where the players visited just like two sessions ago, and were very much and obviously looking forward to meet our characters and probably kill them. So they've been chasing the characters since the beginning without the characters knowing, but the players knowing. And now it finally happened, and I'm glad to say that thanks to, well, some planning and a good die roll and pulling some interesting cards, because in Savage Worlds it's all about the cards. I really like how the encounter tables are, well, pull a card. Is it a face? Yes, then something cool happens. I used that and said, okay, if it's an ace specifically, then the Kahanas will appear. And then that's when I'll have them come along. I want to keep it, as Savage Worlds do, in the cards. So we pulled an ace, and then immediately we also pulled something else. And the connection, the combination of these two things really made a cool session, like with most Savage World sessions in 50 Fathoms. And I just really like it. I had a lot of fun as a GM, and they had a lot of fun as the players, and that's it.
Great. Well, I with the new edition of Savage Worlds, I feel I need to revisit it, because I haven't played it in probably about 7 years now. So,
well, I can run a Crystal Heart game for you.
Well, that's a great idea, yeah.
But it won't be happening today, because today we are now closing off this broadcast or whatever it is. Thank you for listening to us. James, thank you for suggesting the episode and then agreeing to be in it and for iconic it with me. And now I think we should say goodbye in our native languages. Are you ready?
Yeah.
3, 2, 1. Later.
Bye.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves is shared under Creative Commons by attribution non-commercial 4. Intro and outro are by The Cliché Duo. And you can email us at show@dwarfcast.net.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves.